Thanks. So today I'm going to talk about empirical population genomics of functional variants. And the motivation here is to take the sort of our arsenal of techniques we've developed in molecular population genetics and apply it to a really old-fashioned question, one that's at least 80 years old and was for a long time the central question in population genetics. And it's a question that comes from a time when the idea of functional variants would have been redundant, when you only know you have a variant if you see a phenotype. And the last probably 40 years, a lot of molecular population genetics has really been about allozymes or sequence variation, where we've gotten a little bit away from the connection between genotype and phenotype. And there are a lot of questions that we can't address if we only have sequence data, if we only have signatures of selection, if we don't have the whole link between genotype and phenotype and fitness. And so the question that I'm trying to address here is this old-fashioned one. What are the causes of heritable phenotypic variation? And this was, I think, through the middle of the last century, the central question in population genetics. And of course, we've known forever what the basic outline of the answers have to look like. And there are a couple of different categories of explanation. And Dobzhansky in the 50s sort of made a caricature of what the two sort of extreme n-member models might be. And those are Dobzhansky's classical model and his balance model. And the classical is this idea that most new mutations are deleterious and that the variation we see standing in populations is the result of a balance between mutation introducing variation and selection eliminating it. And the alternative view is that new mutations are conditionally beneficial, and some fraction of new mutations will be maintained by selection favoring diversity. And so these two models, that variation is simply due to deleterious mutation or variation is due to selection maintaining variation, have been recognized as the obvious components of a complete explanation for variation for a very long time. And the trouble has been to distinguish, there have been two difficulties. The first is to distinguish the relative importance of these two models. Everybody knows that they're both involved. We want to know how much for each. And the second is to apply them to specific cases of phenotypic variation for a particular phenotype. Can we decide whether the variation we observe in nature is due to mutation selection balance or selection to maintain that variation? And Dobzhansky, more than 50 years ago, said, in effect, this is the basic problem of population genetics, understanding this distribution of variation in natural populations. The problem hasn't been solved yet. We're still in the data gathering stage. So that's 1955. If we skip ahead about 50 years, we see that we're in kind of the same situation. We know that mutation and balancing selection are responsible for this stuff, but we don't know the relevant importance. And in this review, Barton and Keatley, several years ago, proposed a way out of this morass, which I think is a very promising approach, and that is to identify the frequency and sequence structure of the alleles at QTL. QTL are quantitative trait loci. These are the genes in natural populations that affect quantitative phenotypes. So the basic scenario here is that we need to identify the variants that affect phenotypes and then apply molecular population genetic techniques to those variants to understand why these things that affect phenotypes are variable in populations. So basically, I'm going to be advocating a lot of QTL mapping. That's the basic method that I think has a lot of promise for this. And I'm going to show first an example of how this has been applied very successfully. And then I'm going to talk about mostly about my own work trying to make C. elegans, the microscopic nematode model system, into a system where we can rapidly get to functional variants and apply population genetic techniques. And then I've got a big C. elegans data set where we have literally thousands of QTLs where I think we can begin to see the outlines of sort of a global picture of the causes of variation in C. elegans populations. So to begin with a simple example of how this all could be done, I'm going to show you a published study from Sarah Tishkoff and colleagues on human lactase persistence. This is a very famous polymorphism in humans. The phenotype is the ability to digest lactose in adults. And this is a trait that varies among human populations and within populations, and it's been known for a very long time. And there's been a lot of debate about whether the variation we see in nature is the result of selection or simply population bottlenecks. And I think, you know, I think the evidence has been in for a long time that this is a selected trait, but to identify the variants and understand their population genetics is the sure way to get at that question. So the first step in any of these QTL to population genetic studies is to map the variants. And so in this case, using both linkage and association, they've been able to map the variants that affect lactase persistence to an intron of this gene MCM6. And within that interval, using again mostly association mapping, they've identified a variety of single nucleotide polymorphisms that occur in different human populations, and each of which is associated with this persistence trait in the different populations. So each population has a unique derived allele that is associated with lactase persistence. And that's purely a correlation. What we really need is the functional evidence that these things are affecting this phenotype. And these are in an intron, they're non-coding. And so the inference is that they are affecting regulation of a transcript. And indeed, if when these variants are hooked up to reporters and transfected into cultured cells, we do see that these derived variants confer slightly higher transcription rates to the reporter. So these things do have a functional phenotypic effect on transcription.
Yeah. You're putting the intron in front of the reporter gene.
That's right. That's right. Yes. And there's a reason for that, which I suppose I should have said earlier, which I'll go back to now. The reason is that this MCM6 gene is right next to lactase. And so from biological principles, one assumes that these variants are affecting not MCM6, but lactase transcription. And so although they are superficially in an intron of MCM6, we think functionally they're in the promoter of lactase.
Right. I mean, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
What is debatable, I guess, is the expression of the reporter when you stick it right in front of it.
Yes.
It's reflective of what it will do when it's in this intron.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And this is a problem for all functional validation of variants. And with quantitative effects, it becomes increasingly difficult. And this is one of the reasons that I think humans, although they're profoundly the most powerful system for studying genotype-phenotype correlations, are not the best system for studying functional effects of variants. And so I think C. elegans and yeast in particular are the ways to go within animals at least. So it's absolutely right that it's not a biologically plausible assay, but I think the sort of minimum threshold that these assays have to show is that the cell can tell the difference between the alleles, and that's what this assay is showing. So having now identified these variants that are affecting lactase persistence, we can apply all of our favorite molecular population genetic tests. Here's looking at extended haplotype homozygosity. And indeed, in each of these populations, the derived allele has a signature of positive selection driving its rapid increase in frequency. So this is a very straightforward case where we can go from identifying the variants by mapping, functionally validating them, and then showing that they have a signature of positive selection.
Would you call this a quantitative trait?
That's a really good question. It actually is a quantitative trait. And this variant only explains, I'm going to blank on the actual numbers, but I think it's on the order of half the variance in this phenotype. So this is a very large effect locus, but it is a quantitative trait.
You say, in the reporter assay, there's only a quite modest difference in the expression.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so I think the basic point is right that we can't overinterpret. We shouldn't overinterpret the results of the reporter assay. They tell us that cells can tell the difference. But if we were forced to come up with excuses for why the difference isn't bigger, we could say, well, maybe there's a nonlinear relationship between lactase transcript and lactase protein. Maybe there's a nonlinear relationship between the protein and the efficacy of digesting lactose. Maybe these cell types that they were transfected into are not the relevant ones, and so forth. And another possibility is that, in fact, these things have much larger effects in cultured cells that come from the appropriate genetic background that's sort of ethnically matched. So this is a quantitative trait. This explains only part of the variance. It could be that there's epistatic variants that are required to get the full effect on transcription. So, we can make up lots of stories.
So please explain what
Are you going to explain what we're looking at here?
Or? I was hoping not to, but so this is one example of of many different kinds of statistical tests we can use to ask whether a particular variant has been under positive selection, using, for the most part, neutral models as a null hypothesis. And in this case, the statistic that's being evaluated is the length of the linkage disequilibrium block surrounding the variant. And so if a new mutation arises and increases rapidly in frequency, there's not very much time for linkage disequilibrium to decay around it. So this haplotype block will be very large. And so this is basically a sort of visual representation of a statistical test which says, indeed, these derived alleles have much longer haplotypes than expected.
What's the expected? Where's the long one?
In this case, they're comparing it to the alternative allele. And there are formal tests that are based on neutral model assumptions that can evaluate this. But this is, I mean, there's obviously gazillions of different statistical tests that can be used.
So does this distinguish at all between the alternative hypothesis that there's something linked to those sites that they're being swept along with?
I think that it, I would say basically no. Yeah. And that's always going to be a problem. We're limited by the number of meiosis in population history for all of these things. So the one thing I'll just say here, I'll say two things about that point. The first is that if we just did a search for the signature of selection without knowing anything about phenotype, we would say, aha, MCM6 is under positive selection. And that's not really what we think is going on here. And the second thing is that one of the great advantages, actually, this is my next slide. I'll just show it.
I'm sorry, so this control SNP there doesn't come from the same region, does it?
Yes, it's the alternate allele at the same site. The ancestral allele has.
So the argument is that the linkage block for the alternate allele is around to shorten as much as possible. It doesn't matter if this one is kept long.
It's not that it's kept long, it's young. It appeared more recently, and its frequency is higher than expected given its age. So it's not just that these haplotypes are longer, it's that there's too many of the long ones.
Kind of surprising that in Africans. Oh, I guess.
Sure. This is within a specific African population in which there's been a reasonably historically recent domestication of milk as food. In which there has been an independent mutation which affected this lactase persistence trait.
Unless I don't have it. So I don't know if you did it in a population that you expect to have the phenotype, but does not have the phenotype.
Right. Yeah, I think that's been done, and I think it's probably in this paper, actually. But this is, again, just an example of the sort of protocol that we're hoping to take. Find the variants, functionally validate them, do molecular population genetics.
I'm still confused. This is the same way how old the mutation, right? By looking at the size
right.
So, but here you said that you assume you know how old the mutation is.
Oh, no. No.
No, the basic idea is simple. You have a new mutation occurring, and it will, and you'll be initially linked to the entire, all of the particular variants on that whole chromosome. Each generation, recombination will whittle down the size of that. And so from the actual size of this linkage block, you can estimate how old it is. That's one way to estimate the age. There's also a separate independent relationship between age and allele frequency. That is to say, all new mutations start out at 1 over n or 1 over 2n in the population. And under neutrality, in any case, they drift up, and the frequency is, in some sense, an estimate of the expected age. And so, what you're playing off here, these particular mutations actually are fairly common in these populations, and yet they're young.
Yeah, but more believable. Haplotype diversity would be more believable. If you could show that haplotype diversity in this population is low, compared to...
Right. Well, this effectively what it's showing is that within this class, it's very low, and that this class is larger than expected given its haplotype length inferred age.
Yeah. So we should put the two papers up on the wiki, the synthetic paper which describes this, and another by Tamajian.
Yeah. Thank you.
is this the year transfer test?
Sorry?
Is this kind of the haplotype from the velocity test?
Yeah. There's this. This protocol of eventually getting from functional variant to molecular population genetics gives us a couple advantages, I think, over the historically more common thing of just looking at sequence data and inferring selection. So one thing that we can get this way that's not accessible to a lot of other approaches is stuff about molecular function. And so one question is, what are the kinds of mutations that affect phenotypes? Are they SNPs? Are they indels? Are they transposon insertions? We actually have to identify the things to know. Yeah.
Sorry. To finish that story, right? So can you put an estimate from these sizes and frequencies on how much fitter this
Oh yeah.
And is that the number that comes out is sensible with what you might think? It helps you if you can digest. Like
yeah. That? So it depends what your intuition is, because the numbers end up being extremely high, right? These mutations are very, very recent and at very high frequency. So you have to, from the data, we would infer a very strong selection favoring these derived alleles. And, you know, my intuition is that, well, you know, I could do without milk, no big deal. But historically, that's clearly not been the case. So, yeah, I think...
What's the number?
I think it's like above 0.3.
Selection?
Yeah. And I'm sort of guessing from memory what that is, but it's shockingly large. That's all I can say for sure. So we'd like to know whether SNPs are the things that matter, or indels, or transposons, or gene copy number variation, all these things that we study in the context of genome organization evolution. We want to know which of these things actually affects phenotypes. The second question we might ask is, what are the common mechanisms of translation between genotype and phenotype? So are the variants that matter in populations amino acid variants in proteins, or are they regulatory, or do they affect RNA stability, and so forth? And we might go further and ask whether these different kinds of mutations at the mechanistic level have different mechanisms maintaining them in populations. So we actually have to identify them before we can address that question. And finally, we can address the relationship between mutation and phenotype. So for example, we'd like to know information about the effect size of variants that actually segregate in populations. And we have to, again, get down to single variants before we can evaluate their effect sizes. We can also then, in an informed way, evaluate the epistasis and pleiotropic effects of individual mutations. All of this requires mapping stuff to nucleotides. But the point that I was going to make to Steve is that if we have a variant in hand and we're just asking whether it's under selection, we can do very clean hypothesis tests. And so much of molecular population genomics has been genome-wide scans, where either we simply identify the tails of the distribution and say, well, here's the interesting stuff, or we have some genome-wide null model that allows us to estimate the fraction of stuff in the tails that's going to be important. And these are, to some extent, you know, problematic insofar as distributions have tails regardless. And so I think it's a very appealing prospect that if we can point to a variant and ask just about it, we're doing a single straightforward hypothesis test, and I think that's, you know, that's got some advantages. Obviously, for a lot of questions in population genetics, we want to, you know, infer parameters and so forth, but in this context, I think it's nice that we can just ask a simple question. So that was just sort of an example of the protocol. Now I'm going to tell you about the work we're doing to make C. elegans into a good system for finding nucleotides. So C. elegans is this little nematode worm. It's about a millimeter long. They have a lot of great advantages for all aspects of biological research, but in particular for finding the alleles underlying natural variation. They have a couple of great virtues as an experimental system. So one is that they have a 3-day generation time, which means that we can do crosses very quickly and make a lot of progress rapidly. Another advantage is that they are self-fertile, and they occur in nature primarily as totally inbred strains, so we can self them, make inbred lines very quickly. There's no inbreeding depression or anything like that. Another great advantage is that we can freeze them. This is actually huge in importance. And it means, among other things, that we don't have to worry about mutation accumulation in our stocks as we pass into them. We can just put them aside and come back to them. And a final thing that's sometimes a virtue and sometimes a disaster is that they have very low levels of polymorphism. So obviously, when we get to the part where we're doing our molecular population genetics tests, we're going to have power problems because there's just not enough variation to do informative tests. But in the getting to the genes underlying phenotypes part, we have a big advantage because we have fewer variants to worry about. So that's a big trade-off. So the basic approach for finding the genes underlying traits are linkage and association. That's where we follow the correlation between genotype and phenotype in a cross where we know whose parents are whose, and association where we just sample a population and look for a correlation between genotype and phenotype. And one of the beautiful things about both of these methods is that they have the character of an ideal experiment. And I mean ideal experiment in the Fisherian sense. So I just want to mention this lovely paper by Fisher from 1926, where he lays out the case for this sort of experiment in the context of field work. No aphorism is more frequently repeated in connection with field trials than that we must ask nature few questions, or ideally one at a time. But the writer, that's Fisher, is convinced that this view is wholly mistaken. Nature will best respond to a logical and carefully thought out questionnaire. Indeed, if we ask her a single question, she will often refuse to answer until some other topic has been discussed. So this is Fisher's archaic personification of nature, third person about himself kind of articulation of this idea that instead of controlling everything and varying one thing at a time, we should just vary everything and detect the additive effect of each variable. So this is a beautiful argument that if we're interested in the effect of something, then it may have dependence on background. If we randomize over all the backgrounds, then we can find the additive effect across all of those things. And that's a good way to discover causes in field experiments, but it's also a great way to discover genes underlying traits. And the basic model is simply replicated randomized multifactorial perturbation. And a genetic cross has this character. We take the initial genomes and we randomize them, and now every variant in the initial strains is a perturbation, and they're randomized, and we measure each individual strain, and that gives us replication across all of the loci. So a simple kind of experimental cross would be the production of recombinant inbred lines. We start with two inbred strains, we cross them to make a totally heterozygous F1. We then sibmate or self the F1 to get heterogeneous F2s, and we self or sibmate those guys to get totally inbred, recombinant inbred lines, which now are fixed for a mosaic of pieces from the initial starting genomes. So we've randomized these perturbations. We measure each of them. It's randomized replicated multifactorial perturbation. And one of the things that I think is really nice about this is that Fisher discovered it in the context of field experiments, but he also discovered it in the context of natural selection, because it's exactly how natural selection works, right? We have randomization in both cases by meiosis. We have replication in one case by time and population size, and in the other case by the size of our experimental cross. And in each case, we've got this multilocus standing variation, which forms the multifactorial component of the perturbation. So Fisher pointed out that if we randomize over all these backgrounds, it's the additive effect that selection detects. And that's exactly what we do when we do quantitative genetics. We're randomizing over all the backgrounds, looking for the additive effect, this time on the phenotype. And it's a very powerful method, or we wouldn't be here at all. So that's the approach. The cross that I've been using involves these two strains of C. elegans. N2 is from Bristol, England. It's the standard laboratory wild type. And we've got a strain from Hawaii that was collected in the 70s, CB4856. And everything, all of my slides are going to be colored orange and blue so we can keep the genotypes apart. It's very convenient. These guys differ at something on the order of 200,000 sites across the genome. And so the next step is to randomize the genomes and measure them in replicated ways and then identify the variants out of these 200,000 that are affecting phenotypes. So we've got to randomize, and if we simply made recombinant inbred lines in the way I described, we'd have a little bit of a problem because C. elegans has a very low rate of recombination. They have, each chromosome is 50 centimorgans, and they have complete crossover interference. So you get one breakpoint per meiosis, and actually you get 50% of a breakpoint on average per meiosis. So that's a very low rate. So we need a way to increase the randomization. And because the generation time is 3 times, all we need to do is mate them to one another for lots of generations in a big population. So we just add meiosis to increase the randomization of the genome. And this is called an advanced intercross. And we can follow the advanced intercross by selfing lines to make advanced intercross inbred lines. This is a diversion, but it turns out that it matters a little bit how you cross the strains in order to increase the effective length of the genetic map. And we've got a paper that goes through all of the possible permutations of different kinds of mating strategies. And it turns out that, happily, the very easiest thing, which is just to randomly mate pairs of individuals and take two of their offspring for the next generation, works beautifully. It's no problem at all. And the key to this whole thing is that in random mating, variance in offspring number among families absolutely skews things so that you get rapid, even in the absence of selection, you get huge allele frequency drift in this context. But if you equalize the contribution of the offspring, the next generation, this is a known result that you double the effective population size. So that's the advantage of this equal contribution.
Can you freeze them between? So can you keep track of the whole history?
Well, we can't. We could do something vaguely similar to that, but the basic problem is that in freezing, the recovery rate is a variable, and it can be as high as 80%, but we pretty much don't freeze individual worms, we freeze populations of worms. So what we could have done, and certainly should have done, is save each worm and get DNA from it so we could track the whole pedigree. But actually, from freezing the final lines at the end, we can do very well in inferring from the pedigree what's happened to the various alleles, and I'll show you some results on that.
So the way this works, you're actually taking pairs of worms and putting them next to each other, or you put two populations of worms
pairs of worms.
Pairs of worms.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds.
This always works.
No, this almost always works. This almost always works. It works more than 90% of the time. And there's sometimes, so that's if you have just two wild-type worms, 90% of the time. In the cross, sometimes the crosses don't work, possibly because of segregating variants that make the males less good at mating, make the hermaphrodites sterile, all sorts of things. So there's absolutely probably selection on mating efficiency during the cross. But generally, putting two worms on a plate, they'll do what they're supposed to.
And you can distinguish selfing from cross?
More or less. So the basic thing is that a selfing hermaphrodite produces entirely hermaphrodite offspring, and a cross produces 50% males. So if we see 50% males, we assume that the hermaphrodite siblings are cross progeny, and that seems to be almost always the case. So I've got 236 of these highly recombinant inbred lines. More would be better, but frankly, two worms on a plate over 10 generations is a lot of work. So this is our starting data, and now we've genotyped these at 1,454 SNP loci distributed across the genome. So we can reconstruct which pieces of the two initial strains were inherited by each of the recombinant inbred lines. And so I can show you the whole genotype data set in this one slide. Each row here, no, each column, excuse me, represents one of these recombinant inbred lines, and each row represents a SNP marker on chromosomes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or the X chromosome. So as you read down, you're reading the genotype of a single strain. It's got alternating bits that are blue and orange. As you read across, you see that there's some blue strains and some orange strains. That gives us, for each row, when we measure all these things, we've got huge replication across the two alleles at each locus. So that's the basic notion of the replication in the multifactorial perturbation. So,
these represent mutations relative to some?
These represent differences between the two starting strains, N2 and Hawaii. Yeah.
Doesn't it only seem that there is more orange than there is green?
It does not just seem that. It is that, and I'll come back to that. Yep. So one thing we can get immediately from this is a very precise map of recombination rates across the genome. which will become very relevant eventually. And so here are some MERI maps which show the physical position of each marker in megabases versus the genetic position of each marker starting at zero on the left end. And so the slopes of these black lines here represent the recombination rates along the chromosomes. So, you know, in the centers here, you see that a particular amount of physical distance represents a small amount of genetic distance. That's a low recombination rate. In the arms, that same amount of physical distance has a higher genetic distance, more recombination. So you can see a couple of things here. The first is that recombination rates vary in similar ways among all the chromosomes. There are low recombination centers, there are high recombination arms, and there are very low recombination tips on every chromosome, where there's effectively no recombination events at all in the recombinant red lines.
These are all metacentric chromosomes?
These are holocentric. So there's no centromere, they don't have kinetochores, and there are genes distributed along the entire thing. So there's no like heterochromatic anything in here.
So the fraction of crosses that are lethal, mm-hmm. this is just low enough such that this will not affect these sort of estimates. That it's really the rate of recombination instead of...
Right. Yeah. So that's a great question. These are inferred on the basis of observed recombination fractions, and the relationship between that and meiotic recombination is actually very problematic. And even in the absence of selection across, it's kind of a messy conversion. There's some nonlinearities that result in biases that people haven't quite figured out how to deal with. But in the presence of selection, forget about it. These are not going to precisely represent actual recombination rates. And so I think the main thing that we can get from this is that there are these domains of more or less constant rate. We don't know exactly what those rates are, but you know, we can see that there's higher recombination arms and low recombination centers, and there's more or less discrete boundaries between these. So that's the point from this. But for sure, if there's selection that favors one allele, then we'll be able to observe fewer of the actual recombination events because all of the chromosomes will be fixed for the same alleles there. When they recombine, we won't see a breakpoint. And so that's going to cause us to underestimate the recombination rate from the recombination fraction. Absolutely. So this is from recombinant inbred lines. We've also got data from wild strains of C. elegans. We've got individuals from a bunch of localities around, sort of around the world, mostly from Western Europe and Western North America. And so this looks like pretty horrible sampling, and it is, but it's also worth pointing out that these guys do not occur in the eastern United States. So you may have heard from Sidney Brenner that every spoonful of soil contains a million C. elegans, but it's really not true. They have geographic distributions that we're just beginning to figure out, but they don't occur in the eastern United States. So at any rate, we've got a bunch of individuals from a modest number of localities, and we can now we've genotyped these at the same markers as in the recombinant inbred lines, and now we can look at linkage disequilibrium among these variants in natural populations. So linkage disequilibrium is just the correlation between alleles at two loci, and recombination over time should cause linkage disequilibrium to decay. And of course, this linkage disequilibrium is also a function of the recombination rate between the two markers. So markers that are further apart should have lower disequilibrium than ones that are closer apart because there's more meiotic events between them, recombination events. So from the linkage disequilibrium data in these wild strains, we can calculate, or estimate, I should say, we can estimate the population effective recombination parameter rho, which is just the recombination rate scaled by the population size and the selfing rate. So the black line here shows a sliding window of that estimate. And you can see just by inspection that indeed the arms have higher population effective recombination rates than the centers. So it mirrors the meiotic recombination map in a reasonably good way. And I'm showing in these horizontal lines, those are the estimates for the whole domain, centers and arms, of the recombination rate from the recombinant inbred lines and this row from the wild isolates. And you can see that, again, at this domain level, there's a good correspondence between high rho and high recombination rates on the arms and lower in the centers. So recombination in nature is conforming with the patterns that we expect from the patterns we observe in the lab. There's another interesting thing to observe here, though, which is that in the centers, these estimates of rho, these red lines here, or the black lines that go beneath them, are sitting right on zero. And this means that in nature, linkage disequilibrium does not decay with distance in the centers of the worm chromosomes. Right? There's so little outcrossing and such a low meiotic recombination rate that these centers are basically gigantic linkage disequilibrium blocks where there's no decay with distance. It's really a remarkable thing. We're talking about megabases and megabases of DNA. So this is profoundly different from Drosophila, very different from humans, different from Arabidopsis, which has a very similar mating system. So worms have very high, inconveniently high, linkage disequilibrium.
And it's not a founder effect. It's not from the fact that diversity is low. Diversity is high enough that it shouldn't happen if the centers were recombining at a normal rate. If you had only a single strain, you would never see. If you have a weird diversity where in the center you have no diversity and on the arms you have a lot.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, so in this case, we have enough markers to be able to detect decay of linkage disequilibrium in these regions. But there is a big effect of population structure, for sure. So some of these things have very high linkage disequilibrium. The strains are very similar genome-wide, and that contributes to linkage disequilibrium. And so, in fact, if we look at unlinked sites on different chromosomes and look at the correlations between these markers, we see that, in fact, different chromosomes have very high levels of linkage disequilibrium between sites on them. So sites on chromosome 2 are in very high linkage disequilibrium with sites on chromosome 3, and both 2 and 3 with the X chromosome. But in fact, it's genome-wide. There's a huge excess of points across this whole thing. So there's huge linkage disequilibrium across unlinked chromosomes, and this has implications for population biology, but it also has implications for association mapping. And to a large extent, it means that that's a lost cause, although I'll show you that there are cases where we can manage it. So let me return to this question of whether there's too much orange in this picture of the genotypes. And so I'm just going to plot for each marker along each chromosome the frequency of orange as we move along the chromosomes. And so,
can you explain why you have this effect on chromosomes?
Why there's too much orange?
No.
No.
Oh.
Why you have linkage across the chromosome? So is it, did you explain it by as a found effect? Or epistasis?
No. So I think this is not evidence for epistasis. I mean, that's certainly a hypothesis that would generate this. But I think in this case, what we're seeing is that strains in different parts of the world have very recent ancestors between which time there's been no outcrossing events.
And so similarly, this complete linkage disequilibrium in the centers, which doesn't quite square with your meiotic recombination map. This you also explain just by absence of variation.
Well, so some of that effect
by
is
population structure.
Some of that effect is definitely population structure.
Acting on recombinant events and pushing them up.
Right. I think that we can't answer that from these data very well. But to me, these actually have the wild isolates resembling the laboratory strains very, very well. It's just that the magnitudes are different, so that the zeros we see in rho are, you know, lower than expected, lower than the recombination rate, but they're, you know, appropriately lower relative to the arms, sort of. So indeed, population structure explains some of this, but the variation along chromosomes isn't population structure. That's variation in recombination rate in nature.
The fact that you see these associations across chromosomes is a very strong indication that there's not much recombination going on in nature. Basically, you know, hermaphrodites make themselves essentially have these more or less clonal lineage in which everything, all the chromosomes associate. And there's sort of the common misunderstanding, even between chromosomes, if there is some initial association between chromosomes, it still only decays at 50% per generation. With recombination, because it's still 1 minus R, which is 50% for segregation, for assortment chromosomes. The T. So it doesn't, in one generation, it doesn't go to equilibrium. The fact that it exists really indicates, you know, that these things are very, very recent.
So
as to now, in the sense that the time on which you recombine and randomize is small compared to the time up to the common ancestor of these natural populations. Is that what it says?
Is that the common ancestor is recent relative to the recombination events? Right. Yeah.
It's here the other way around. That the common ancestor is more recent than the recombination.
Yes, exactly.
But can you repeat what, I mean, for these unnamed parts, what made you sort of skeptical against what these cases as a possible false?
To some extent, it's system of belief, but basically, it's that we know these things are selfing in nature; that they have very little outcrossing, and so, as Marty explained, we expect them to have linkage disequilibrium among chromosomes purely by population history.
But didn't you, so? Wasn't it sort of more like spots? I mean, or was it over the whole?
It's elevated over the whole, but there are definitely regions that are higher than everywhere else. But that's it could be an accident of which strains have been sampled and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I should say that the sampling is really very insufficient at the moment, and that's obviously something that needs work.
I know this has to play into something we've been discussing. As you point out, there's quite low variation here, and even though, again, maybe it's not in the eastern United States,
right.
Still population size of C. elegans has to be immense.
Mm-hmm.
And again, although there's population structure, you still find the same variations in different places. So they do move around and spread, not necessarily as a worldwide global pandemic population,
right.
But they're definitely mixed. And still there's very little variation. So there must be clones that come to predominate the whole species.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
And you think that would go beyond chromosomes, so to say?
Well, if you get a hermaphroditic kind of clonal lineage that spreads, it'll link the variation on all those chromosomes.
So let me show you the...
To the extent that the hermaphroditic system itself, there's no variation. To the extent that there is variation, the argument doesn't apply. So then you have to worry about what those recombinants, there's very little, but there is some.
But they mostly don't outcross. So there can be variation existing within populations, but linkage disequilibrium isn't going to decay until they mate with someone who's got a different genotype. And that's what's rare in nature. So let me show you the frequency plot. Sorry.
No, I don't. I think Boris had a very good argument, right? That if there is variation, this must come from recombination events, no?
Well, it can arise from mutation, right? So the question is whether there's variation that's shared among populations that's not in disequilibrium. And so that's evidence for recombination events, and there's absolutely some of that here, but it's simply low relative to the recency of ancestry of the different strains.
But it does seem paradoxical to say that the reason that you're seeing the strong linkage is because clones are sweeping populations, and yet there's not loss of variation. There's some variation that's not just the variation between clones,
right.
And just point mutations. The variation between clones is spread out over the genome. So how do you explain that? Do you explain that by balancing selection or?
Right. So my honest answer is that my intuition says population structure does most of the work here, but quantitatively we don't know. And these data aren't going to get us there, in part because of ascertainment bias, which I'm not even going to talk about today. But for sure, there are a lot of questions about C. elegans population biology that we just have no idea. And it's only been in the last few years that people have actually tried to sample them in nature. And we need more of that. So within the recombinant bred lines, there's a bias toward orange alleles at certain locations. If we just plot the orange allele frequency along the chromosomes, we see that on chromosome 1 here in red, there's a huge excess of Bristol alleles at this position on the left arm of chromosome 1. And here we can use the pedigree that we use to make the cross to simulate chromosomes, and it turns out we should never see anything sticking out of these gray boxes, basically. So this requires selection as an explanation. Basically we're looking at a selective sweep that happened during the crossing. Obviously, this the way we did the cross, there has to be very strong selection because the cross design is basically a mutation accumulation design in some sense. There should be, you know, no selection unless something is lethal. But Bristol and Hawaii are both perfectly viable strains, so there has to be epistasis involved as well. And so we went back to these strains and did a bunch of crosses following this chromosome 1 region to figure out what was going on. And so if we simply do these crosses, if we self an F1 individual or sigmate F1 individuals, a male and a hermaphrodite, and look at the viability of the offspring, in each of these cases, we have a quarter lethality. So a quarter of the offspring die from this cross. And if we genotype them at chromosome 1, it turns out that the dead guys are all the ones that are homozygous for the Hawaii alleles in this chromosome 1 region. So Hawaii chromosome 1 is lethal in some kind of epistatic background from the Bristol genome. So we figured this out by doing reciprocal crosses between F1 males and Hawaii hermaphrodites and Hawaii males and F1 hermaphrodites. So in this case, half of the progeny should be Hawaii homozygotes. And we see 50% lethality only in this cross and effectively none in this cross. So what this is telling us is that there is an interaction between homozygosity for the Hawaii alleles and a paternal Bristol chromosome. So it's a paternal effect by zygotic interaction. And to cut a very long story very short, we've cloned the interacting loci. Turns out that that the paternal effect thing is a protein coding gene that is in the, brought in with the sperm somehow. And if this sperm carries a Hawaii haplotype of the two interacting loci, the zygotic and the paternal effect loci, which are tightly linked, then in the context of a Hawaii oocyte, we get this gene, this embryo that's homozygous for the Hawaii alleles, but carries this paternal effect protein, and those guys die. So the Bristol allele of the paternal effect locus kills embryos that don't inherit the gene that makes the paternal effect locus.
It's a surface gene.
It has that appearance, yes, absolutely. So we cloned these guys. They're tightly linked. Now we can do molecular population genetics. So just to show you what we're looking at here, we map them to this interval of a bunch of genes. We used transgenic rescue to show that this piece of DNA here is sufficient to rescue the embryos that would otherwise die. So if we put this gene into a Hawaii strain, then that 50% lethality that we expect goes away. So this is sufficient to stop the paternal effect from killing the worms. We now know actually that the paternal effect gene is a thing that was not predicted or annotated, but it's a perfectly good protein coding gene that exists right here. So not shown in this picture. So it's the zygotic and the paternal effect genes right next to one another. And if we look at the sequence divergence between these two strains, Hawaii and Bristol, through this region, we find a very unusual and unexpected pattern. So genome-wide, these strains differ at one base pair in 500 or in 1,000, not that much polymorphism. But within this interval, from about here to about here, the divergence between the strains is off the chart. And in fact, the introns and intergenic regions are completely unalignable. And the protein coding sequences differ at synonymous sites by about 15%. So orders of magnitude higher divergence in this haplotype interval than elsewhere in the genome. And these red triangles represent insertions and deletions of various size. So the Hawaii haplotype is actually completely missing the zygotic and the paternal effect locus. So we have to explain this hugely elevated divergence between these two strains. And so we looked at the distribution of these things in nature by phenotyping. So we did crosses between the wild strains to see which ones would die in which ways from all of the crosses.
The two genes that Bristol has that Hawaii doesn't have at all.
That's right. So when we look out in nature, we see that globally, both of these haplotypes, both of these phenotypes occur, and they co-occur within localities. So at some localities in Germany, a single spoonful of soil contains both of these haplotypes, the one that should kill the other and the one that should die. So they're globally distributed. And at the sequence level, all of the ones that are like Bristol look like Bristol, and all of the ones that look like Hawaii look like Hawaii. So if we just look at a genealogy for a big chunk of sequence in this interval, we get this huge haplotype dimorphism, where all of the Bristol guys are basically identical, and all the Hawaii guys are basically identical. And there's this huge divergence between them of millions of generations. So given that the rest of the genome has basically no diversity at all, I mean, very little diversity between all these strains, this is hugely unexpected. And we could do whatever kind of statistical test we like, you know, to GMSD, et cetera, ad nauseum. This is highly significant evidence for balancing selection, maintaining these two haplotypes for a very long time in worm populations.
This is evidence against diversity being a speciation event. Just because two sequences are different doesn't mean that they're different species. Which
right.
is usually the argument used for
species. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And how big are these blocks?
So the whole thing is about 40. Well, so this thing is about 40 kb.
And then it falls off.
Well, so the diversity drops off immediately, right? From here on, it's exactly genome-wide background. But linkage disequilibrium extends for actually more like 150 kb among, you know, extant strains. So, yeah.
How about other worms? These genes that were missing in one strain or
Great question. Yeah, so PL1, which is not shown here, has no similarity to anything. You know, fell out of space. We have no idea. ZEAL1 is part of a gene family that is specific, that has expanded specifically in C. elegans. So there are a bunch of paralogs in C. elegans, and there's a sort of a separate expansion of related genes in C. brigzi. But we have very little clue as to what these genes do. None of them is functionally characterized. The closest thing that's functionally characterized is, you know, 20% amino acid similarity. It's way out there in elegans, and that's Zyg11, which is a zygotic essential gene, which is a ubiquitin ligase substrate recognition subunit. So, you know, if we wanted to imagine that ZEAL1 is the same kind of subunit, one model is that zygotic expression of this ubiquitin ligase subunit interacts with the PL1 to cause its degradation. And that's how embryos that inherit this gene survive the paternal effect. But again, we're doing the experiments now to figure out the molecular biology of these things, but we have very little handle on what they're doing. Right, if we go a little further out on either side, then we see recombination events. So this is not causing the divergence of these two strains to become different species. This is a sort of a localized event. And so, you know, we don't really know why this is underbalancing selection. It's a bit of a mystery. We have a couple hypotheses that might or might not make any sense. So one scenario is this is a selfish gene, this is genic drive. The Bristol allele of this haplotype kills the Hawaii allele. It should increase in frequency. And we would expect it to fix, as happens in a lot of species with genic drive, within populations. There shouldn't be any variation within populations. And if there's enough exchange among populations, it should sweep through the entire species. And the only reason it wouldn't sweep is if the homozygote is strongly selected against. So that would be like the T alleles in mice, where the T allele has a huge transmission advantage, but when it becomes homozygous, it's lethal. So that's the way we expect balanced polymorphism to work for genic drive. And in this case, these guys exist as homozygotes in nature. So, you know, it's not lethal, and it doesn't appear to be severely deleterious in any way we can detect. Doesn't seem to have any harmful effect on fitness at all. And the incompatible strains co-occur globally in the same spoonful of soil. So genic drive would make a lot of sense if the Hawaii haplotype were extremely rare or localized to a specific place where there were no Bristol haplotypes, but the pattern we see doesn't really look like genic drive. So another model that people sometimes propose is speciation, but as we've seen, there's gene flow across the whole rest of the genome. So this thing is not causing the two strains to become reproductively isolated. They mate perfectly well. So we've come up with a more complicated model, which is at present purely verbal. But it basically relies on the idea of the evolution of Dobzhansky-Mollerin compatibilities, which is the sort of standard model for true speciation. And it goes like this. If you have an ancestral population that becomes split into two isolated populations, then each of those evolves independently and may evolve and fix new mutations at particular loci. So in this lineage, this new mutation little a has fixed, and in this population, this mutation little b has fixed. And if these guys ever come back into contact, little a and little b have never seen each other. They may be incompatible with one another. So when these things come together, there's the possibility that these things which evolved neutrally or under positive selection are now negatively interacting. And so that's the standard Devonansky Muller model for speciation. Those guys are dead, no problem. And that doesn't make a lot of sense for C. elegans because these guys are exchanging genes all the time. And so the model that we like is that the incompatibility is a completely incidental side effect of balancing selection on something else in this interval. Well, possibly on Zeal and Peel, but on something in this interval. So if we suppose that balancing selection is maintaining these two haplotypes for a very long time, and outcrossing is rare enough that they don't see each other very often, then these ancient lineages, this long amount of time that these haplotypes have had to evolve, is sort of like the two haplotypes have been in allopatry. They've been isolated by balancing selection and selfing. And so the ancientness of these haplotypes caused by balancing selection permits incompatible alleles to arise in the same way they do here. It's just that this isolation is restricted to this interval that's under balancing selection. So the rest of the genome is exchanging just fine.
So how would balancing selection work in selfing on the circuit? Right.
Yes, so it's not overdominance. We don't know, but it could be some feature of microhabitat differentiation or fluctuating selection. I mean, we've basically got no idea. One scenario is that it would be pathogen resistance. When a pathogen comes in, one allele increases in frequency because it's resistant, but with a cost, and then, you know, vice versa. But basically, we have no idea.
You already said that you needed balancing selection.
Yes.
And so now, I don't understand, the explanation is there is balancing selection.
Yes. So we need balancing selection to explain the population genetic data. But we also have to explain the maintenance of an incompatibility. So the incompatibility should remove variation. It should fix for the favored allele. And so we have to find an explanation that explains both the maintenance of these two things and the presence of an incompatibility. And so the genic drive model, which accounts for T alleles in mice, explains the maintenance with reference to the incompatibility. And we're trying to explain the incompatibility with reference to the maintenance by balancing selection. So we're trying to flip the explanation on its head in order to accommodate the primarily selfing mode of reproduction in these strains.
Wouldn't that depend very strongly on the degree of selfing compared to the degree of crossing?
Yes.
So you could tune the dial either way.
Yeah. Yeah. So our impression in nature is that these things just outcross so rarely that it doesn't give the driver much chance to sweep, and it does give these two haplotypes time to diverge. But as I say, it's a verbal argument at the moment. Yeah.
So. Does this effect explain all of the overabundance of orange in that early spot?
Well, it explains everything on chromosome 1. And rather than flipping back, I'll say that there's a little region on chromosome 2 that is also skewed toward orange. And we don't have an explanation for that. It's a region of genome that's hugely enriched in large deletions between these two strains and that contains the entirety of a huge tandem gene family expansion. Of MathBTB domain proteins, whose function is kind of poorly understood. So it's a distinctive region of the genome. But again, we need to invoke some kind of epistasis in this context to get it to increase in frequency, and we've got basically no idea about that.
And other chromosomes are reasonably.
Yeah. Yeah, the other chromosomes look fine. The one exception is. So everything looks fine with respect to allele frequencies. There's an exception. There's something that points to non-neutrality on chromosome 3, but it's not allele frequencies. It's genetic map length. So the map of chromosome 3 is smaller than expected, given the cross. And one explanation for that is that there's selection against recombination events between epistatically related loci. So there's a reduction in the observed recombination fraction between some markers.
Did you look at LD when you take your insert lines as a population?
Yeah, so there's... Yeah, so the Mary maps I showed are basically a representation of LD, and there's nothing at all...
The Mary maps?
They're the ones that show physical position versus genetic position. So they just show the estimated recombination fraction.
I mean, like, sort of plot here,
right, yes. So there's absolutely nothing between chromosomes in the recombinant number lines. There's no departure from expectation at all. Perfectly uniform p-values and all that stuff. So yeah, it's a good question. All right, let me return to some more phenotypes, because we've got to get to the genome-wide stuff here. So to remind you about this business with recombination rate variation across the chromosomes, I showed you that rho, the sort of natural estimation of the recombination rate, is lower than the recombinant numbered lines. And the one exception is here on the left side of chromosome 1, where actually the estimate of the recombination rate is lower than the estimate of the population effective recombination rate. And that's because of two different phenomena. One is that we're underestimating the recombination rate in the recombinant numbered lines because the selection skewed the allele frequencies. The increase in the Bristol allele frequency meant that recombination events involved identical chromosomes. They were Bristol on both chromosomes, and so we don't observe those recombination events. So we're underestimating the meiotic recombination rate. But the natural population effective recombination rate is higher on the left side here than anywhere else. And that, we think, is because of this balancing selection. These haplotypes are old, and so they've given this part of the chromosome more time for LD to decay. So that explains the one anomaly with respect to these maps. So I'm going to speed through another Mendelian phenotype and then get to the big quantitative genome-wide stuff. So Mendelian phenotype that we looked at is copulatory plugging. The Hawaii allele males make these big gelatinous blobs that they stick on their mates, and the Bristol strain can't make these gelatinous blobs. And these blobs are a paternity assurance mechanism. So They're like a chastity belt, perhaps. What it means is that if a plugging worm is the first male to mate, then it's going to have a higher fraction of offspring sired than a non-plugging strain would if it were the first male. So that's the important thing, is that if a plugging male makes the plug, then it protects its paternity more than it would if it didn't. And this is a trait that exists in all Caenorhabditis species, but most Caenorhabditis species have males and females. They're obligate outcrossers. And hermaphroditism in C. elegans is a very recent origin. So most C. elegans exist as hermaphrodites, which are selfing, and males are very rare in populations. And so the probability that a male would have to compete with other males for matings is dramatically reduced recently in C. elegans. So we think this is the change that allowed the loss of copulatory plugging to arise and become polymorphic in C. elegans.
When you say recent, what do you have in mind?
Yes. Right. Yeah, so we think that hermaphroditism is older than the incompatibility. Something, if we use similar, well, the current estimate is more like 20 million generations. But the way to estimate that is very fraught. Yeah. So the estimation of the date was done by Asher Cutter in this really clever way, which looks at the decay and codon bias in C. elegans relative to other species. So the origin of hermaphroditism involved this dramatic crash in population size, and so selection on codon usage is dropped dramatically, and so codon usage bias has decayed. And he was able to estimate how much it's decayed. That's really clever stuff. So to map copulatory plugging, we just look at our recombinant numbered line genotypes. And
so is it known why males don't disappear altogether?
Why males don't disappear? No. So it's an active area of research. One model is that when a male does arrive spontaneously, they arise by X non-disjunction males are XO and hermaphrodites are XX. And so males are introduced at a very low frequency spontaneously. And when a male does arise, if it mates, it's usually successful. So if a male is only present every few hundred generations, it's still enough to maintain male function, possibly. It depends on basically a mutational target size for male function, which is unknown.
Why is it more successful?
It can have many more offspring than a hermaphrodite can.
It doesn't quite have potential to the female
function. Because hermaphrodites are sperm limited, so they're sequential hermaphrodites. They make a little pile of sperm, and then they switch to eggs. And so however many sperm they make initially is as many progeny as they can have, and that's typically 200 to 300. But a male can have tens of thousands of offspring.
Maybe you can talk about, do you know when the plug is actually polymorphic in populations?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. I'll show a slide. But it's absolutely intermediate frequency, globally distributed, common in nature. So we did a standard thing of looking for an interval where all of the Bristol guys have no plugging and all the Hawaii guys have plugging. We found it. We looked within this interval. There was no obvious candidate gene, but there was a good candidate mutation because the Bristol strain has a great big retrotransposon, an LTR, sitting right in this region. And it disrupts a completely unannotated open reading frame that no one had seen. And it's no one had seen it because the wild type strain, which has its genome annotated, is defective for this gene. So when we look in the Hawaiian strain, we see this intact gene. And in the Bristol strain, there's this great big insertion right into one of the exons that disrupts the protein. And the intact protein has this nice structure where it's got a secretion signal, and then all of these repeats, which are very rich in threonine and serine and proline. And this is a completely iconic, typical representation of a mucin. So the kind of thing that makes mucus or gelatinous capillary plugs, that kind of thing. So a very appropriate gene in worms. We can do experiments really quickly. We can knock the gene down by RNAi, plugs go away. We can introduce plugs by means of a transgene, plugs appear, necessary and sufficient for plugging, great. We can do all of the fun stuff that worm developmental biologists like to do. I made a GFP transgene, so we can see that it's expressed only in these 12 cells in the male vas deferens, which is right where we'd expect it. And these cells, we can now, these cells had never been characterized before. Nobody pays much attention to the male somatic gonad. But these cells turn out to have these gigantic vacuoles before mating, which collapse upon mating. So we think these are seminal fluid storage vacuoles. So that's just a way of saying that that quantitative genetics and evolutionary genetics is a way to actually get to molecular biology. And that's why we're able to convince molecular biologists that this is a useful exercise. So here's the global distribution. In orange are the non-plugging, in blue are the plugging. You can see they're all over the place. They co-occur within localities, within single scoops of soil. So what we would like to do is to do some molecular population genetics to look at whether this is truly a neutral evolution because selection has just been relaxed, or if perhaps the loss of plugging has been favored, maybe it's energetically costly or something. And here's where we run into the huge disaster of C. elegans, that this gene is in a center of a chromosome, which means that it's in linkage disequilibrium with everything, and we have no power to do any kind of tests at all. So I can show that by demonstrating what happens when we try to association map this phenotype. If we just look for the correlation between phenotype and genotype at every marker along the genome, we get a very large number of markers in black here that are very highly off the charts significantly associated with plugging. And that's on multiple chromosomes. So that's just because markers on chromosome 3, where this gene resides, are in linkage disequilibrium with stuff all over the genome. And so association mapping is really problematic. We can use a more elaborate approach incorporating sort of genomic background similarity between strains, so sort of discounting phenotypic similarity on the basis of genotypic similarity genome-wide. And in that case, we actually do get a unique association right where it should be, but it's an interval that spans more than 2 megabases. So, we're in this funny situation where the cross we did in the lab has much lower LD than the entire C. elegans population in nature. So that's a weird situation. Just for comparison, we actually do really well if we try to association map the incompatibility. And that's, again, because this thing is ancient. It's had time for linkages equilibrium to decay. So we really just get a SNP right adjacent to the thing that we're trying to map. So the short story is that association mapping is not a great strategy in C. elegans on a genome-wide level. So I'm going to show you, we're going to switch now to quantitative phenotypes. And we can measure and map pretty much anything in C. elegans. And there's obviously a huge universe of C. elegans researchers who study lots of different phenotypes. And that gives us huge grounds to discover the genes underlying lots of things. And so I'm just going to show you very briefly a behavior that we've looked at. That's the response of the worms to 100% octanol. I'm going to show you a little movie of Bristol and Hawaii responding to octanol. So here comes the octanol. The Hawaii worm doesn't care at all. It doesn't even notice. The Bristol worm smells it and backs up. So this is a fun phenotype. This is mostly an excuse for me to show how cool these animals are. If we phenotype this in the recombinant hybrid lines, we get this nice distribution where some strains respond very quickly, some strains don't respond noticeably at all, and there's a lot of intermediate stuff. And so we can simply go marker by marker through the genome and ask for each marker whether there's a correlation between genotype and phenotype. That's the whole method of linkage mapping in recombinant hybrid lines. And as we do this, we find a very significant linkage to the X chromosome. And so it's a pretty modest region. And this is just an example of how we do mapping in this panel of strains. It's very straightforward. Now we're dissecting this region to find the actual nucleotides within that interval. And because we can do as many crosses as we like, 3-day generation time, we've got visible markers to help pick recombinants, this stuff goes very quickly. So that was just an excuse to show the video. Let me switch to the main event here, which is transcript abundances. So what we really want to do is not just have one phenotype or two phenotypes, but as many phenotypes as we can gather, find the quantitative trait nucleotides underlying those variants, and then ask molecular population genetics about why there's heritable phenotypic variation in nature. And so transcript abundances give us thousands of phenotypes by microarray. So we've used adjuvant arrays to look at transcript abundances in young adult hermaphrodite worms, and we've done this in 215 strains. So this gives us thousands of transcript abundance phenotypes where we can do the quantitative genetics and find the underlying loci. So let me just walk through.
So these 215 strains are your...
are the recombinant inbred lines.
Orange
one. Right. Yep. So here's a sort of example gene, cell death related to nuclease 3. It has this distribution among the recombinant inbred lines. And so again, the whole thing of the mapping is just to go marker by marker and ask whether there's a correlation between genotype and phenotype. And so at most markers, there's no correlation. But at some markers, like on chromosome 1 at 11.8 megabases, the guys who inherited the Bristol allele have slightly higher cell death-related nuclease 3 transcript abundance than the guys who inherited the Hawaii allele. So then we just do standard QTL mapping statistics to see whether this is significant. We can have genome-wide thresholds and false discovery rates and all of that great stuff. And it is. So this is on chromosome 1. As we go along the whole genome, we get an additional locus. So here's chromosome 1, significant linkage. Here's another significant linkage on chromosome 2. So we've got two regions of the genome that explain variation in cell death-related nuclease 3 transcript abundance. And so if we do this for all of the genes, we'll need a way to plot them. So I'm just going to take these two points here, a spot on chromosome 2 and a spot on chromosome 1, and plot them according to where in the genome the actual cell death-related nucleus gene is. So cell death-related nucleus 3 is here on chromosome 2. So I'm just plotting those two points on a row here. So you see there's one QTL on chromosome 1 and another on chromosome 2. And one thing you can see right away is that this one on chromosome 2 is in about the same position as the gene itself. So the inference is that there's some variant at cell death-related nuclease 3 that affects the abundance of that gene's transcript. So the most natural idea would be that there's a cis-regulatory variant that affects the gene's transcription or affects its RNA stability or so forth. So if we do this for every gene in the genome, then I'll just plot the data on all of these rows, and that looks like this. And you can see a bunch of different interesting patterns here. So one thing is that there's a huge number of linkages of genes, transcript abundances back to their own genomic locations. So a lot of putative cis-regulatory polymorphism. There are a lot of points scattered all over the place, and there are also a lot of these vertical stripes, which represent polymorphisms that are affecting many different transcripts. So there's something here on chromosome 1, some polymorphism that's affecting hundreds of different transcripts. And you can see, you know, there are several of these across the genome. So in the literature, these are often described as master regulator QTLs, which I think is wrong. There's no evidence from this kind of data that the genes underlying these things have any regulatory role per se. They could be simply mutations that are highly pleiotropic. So they could be structural proteins that just disrupt cellular homeostasis or something. They're going to affect lots of other transcripts without being regulators per se. So these stripes are pleiotropic variants.
So I mean, that is a result. So if you take the locations of these stripes and see what kind of function are the genes that you find there, you do not find transcription factors overrepresented.
Well, so in this analysis, from these data, I haven't done that yet. And part of the reason is that these intervals tend to be pretty large, like 20 to 50 genes. Just sort of if you do it straightforwardly. We can't say. That analysis has been done in yeast,
right.
And there was no overrepresentation of transcription factors. So from the same kind of cross design, no overrepresentation of transcription factors.
Yeah. Okay. Could you say a little more about the color code?
Oh, yeah. So the color code is just the significance of the linkage. So the gray ones are less significant, and the red ones are very highly significant. And so this is a pattern that we see routinely, which is that the local linkages tend to be much, much larger in effect size and in significance. But you know, you can see that there are scattered highly significant points where, you know, something on chromosome 3 is having a very strong effect on this gene on chromosome 4. So it's sort of all over the place.
That's what I'm having trouble with. So is there something systematic about how significance is evaluated, that sort of very solid vertical line has to come out gray?
No. There's nothing systematic. I mean, so the thing that's closest to systematic would be that there's more gray than there is orange or red. And so if you have a bunch of things in a stripe, it's going to be grayish compared to a randomly isolated spot. But that simply means that this thing affects many genes, but it affects them kind of weakly. That's sort of the impression that you can take from that. So the pattern that I most want to talk about is something that's kind of subtle here, and it's the distribution of these linkages within chromosomes. So you might be able to sort of see that as you go from the left side of a chromosome to the right, there's an excess of linkages in the arms and a shortage in the center. I mean, it's most obvious here on the X, lots of linkages, not so many here in the middle for every gene. And you can't see it at all in this picture, but it's also true if you just look along the diagonal. There's more linkages in the arms than in the centers. And so I can show this just in a histogram. If we take chromosome 3 and just plot where the QTLs are along this QTL position axis here, and you can see that there's a lot of QTLs in the arms and fewer in the centers. So
it's not because you just have more power to detect them there, because they combine more?
Right. It shouldn't be, in part because detection is not so much... Detection power is not so much related to recombination. It's related to sample size of the two alleles. And so what we would expect is that in a region of low recombination, we would get a wider QTL peak, but its magnitude should be the same. And another way we can sort of exclude that effect is by looking only at the diagonal. So in that case, we're looking at genes that link back to their own genomic positions. And here again, we would expect that in a low recombination region, it should still link back to its own interval, and we see fewer of those in the centers. So the question to ask here is, where do we expect QTLs to be on a chromosome? And my intuition is that they should be where the genes are, right? If you have a piece of chromosome and you throw down mutations, the ones that affect phenotypes are going to be the ones that hit functional stuff. That's going to be exons, that's going to be regulatory sequence, and so forth. And so my sort of naive expectation is that QTLs should correlate with gene density. And it turns out that in C. elegans, gene density is highest in the center. And I'll show you the numbers on that in a minute. But what we see here is that the QTL density is correlated not with gene density, but with recombination rate. And it's been known for a while that in C. elegans, as in pretty much every other organism, there's a correlation between SNP density and recombination rate. So what we're seeing is that these QTLs, these things that affect function, are not falling in the place where there's lots of genes, but in the place where there's lots of SNPs, lots of variation of all sorts. So just to show you again the recombination rate pattern, here's chromosome 3, high in the arms, low in the center, and it sort of nicely mirrors this pattern of QTL density.
So can this be completely explained by SNP density?
Well, that's a very good question, and we basically don't have the data. So the SNP density data are kind of sparse. They're from a shotgun sequencing that was very light coverage a long time ago. And so we have sort of...
But is there a reason why that would be biased to arms or centers?
No, you're right. Yeah, so in that case, then I should say I haven't done an analysis. Yeah.
And is that SNP density on your ship, or is it the density of functional variants in the population?
Sorry, one more time.
So when you have your SNPs on your chip, are they like evenly distributed over the
ship? Oh, right.
Or do they also have this combination?
Right. So the genotyping SNPs are uniform, more or less. And
really, SNPs is the functional variant SNPs that should show up.
Right, exactly. Yep. So this is a global pattern. Here's looking only at local linkages. This is just the diagonal stuff on that plot. And you see in every chromosome, there's more stuff on the arms than in the centers. And it's true as well if we look at distant linkages, although sort of less obvious, there's more stuff on the arms than in the centers. And so if I just take all these and convert it to numbers, if we look at QTLs per megabase of DNA, for both local and distant, on the diagonal and off, there's a big excess of stuff in the arms, a deficit in the centers, and even less in the really low recombination tips. So remember, these low recombination tips, any variant in there that affects a phenotype, we should get a QTL to that tip, and we're getting very few. So this is per megabase, but I have to convert this in terms of gene density. So now I'm going to show you QTLs per 100 annotated genes. So this is, instead of physical distance, it's gene number distance. And here again, there are many more QTLs per gene in the arms than in the centers, and even more than in the tips. So we've got this global pattern where the functional variants are correlated with the recombination rate and not with the gene density. And so this to me is a hugely weird result, because in part it means that the thing that influences phenotypic variation is not the function of the genes, it's where the genes are in the genome, right? So if we go back and ask the initial question, what are the causes of heritable phenotypic variation? At some level, in C. elegans, what we're saying is that it's the genomic distribution of the relevant genes, where they are with respect to recombination rate. So I think that's surprising. And if we want to find an explanation for it, there are two possibilities. One is that that recombination is per se mutagenic. So there's a higher mutation rate in the arms, So there's just a greater influx of functional variance into the arms. And the other possibility is that the correlation between SNP density and recombination rate is due to linked selection, so the Hill-Robertson effect, background selection, and so forth. Simply that in these low recombination regions, the effective population size is tiny because deleterious variants get eliminated from the population and bring that whole region of chromosome with them. That's background selection. And that's a very plausible scenario for the distribution of QTLs in this case. I think that we basically don't have any data, in C. elegans at least, to distinguish between these two things. There's no data that recombination is mutagenic in C. elegans, but there aren't any data that it's not either. I think that at the same time, the linked selection argument is very intuitively compelling, in part because we've seen that the population size and the recombination rate is so low in these selfing populations that it would be really surprising if there weren't very strong background selection. So one thing that I think is interesting about this is that it brings us back to this idea that Fisher discovered, that it's the additive effect of these things that we're detecting. And when we look at the recombinant hybrid lines compared to the wild strains, what we see is that in the wild strains, the randomization has been done really badly. And so the additive effect of these things is hard to pick up. And so I think that's a nice sort of crossing event between these two different fields of research. So I'm going to continue to one more topic. I don't know if there's a convention for a break or something.
There is,
okay. I'll keep this last bit very brief. The basic question for this last bit is whether we can use molecular data and mapping data on the identities of QTLs to improve our models of the evolution of correlated traits. So we've got this nice evolutionary quantitative genetic, this body of knowledge that involves the response to selection and its relationship to heritability. And in the multivariate context, you know, we have multivariate heritability in effect, which relates to the genetic correlation among traits and the phenotypic correlation among traits. And when we have thousands of traits like this that exhibit correlations, it would be nice if we could untangle that a little bit so that instead of having this huge nasty matrix of genetic correlations, we could talk more about the actual causal network of interactions among these things, so that we can talk about variation in populations in terms of not just global correlations, but causal interactions. And so what I want to talk about is how we can use QTL data to improve on sort of old-fashioned path analysis in order to causally order things, so that instead of saying, you know, these two phenotypes are correlated, we can say that this phenotype causes the variation in the other phenotype. And this is a thing that this kind of QTL data is really superb for. So the basic problem is that we've got multiple traits and we'd like to causally order them, and they're all correlated with one another. So we have a QTL that could independently affect two traits, or it might affect trait one affects trait two, and so forth. And we'd like to be able to use the phenotype data in conjunction with the QTL data to distinguish among these possibilities. And so I'll just show you one phenotype where that I'll use as an example for the basic model here. This is the abundance of a gene called SED1, which is cell death regulator 1. This is an important gene in apoptosis in C. elegans. And I've got three probes on my microarray, and each of these probes gives the same result, which is that the Bristol genotype is associated with higher expression than the Hawaii genotype. But you can also see that there's tons of variation that's not explained by genotype at this QTL. So the QTL has an effect, but there's lots of variation left over. So what we'd like to do is to exploit this extra variation to look at its correlation with other traits in order to produce a causal ordering. So
what's the difference between these three?
These are simply different probes that are measuring the same gene. So it's just different sections of the transcript.
So all these things that you're correcting for, all these effects that the probes may have the Bristol or the difference between these guys too small.
So the actual, we don't actually know which probes might have SNPs in them, because we don't have complete Hawaii data. But the expectation is that it's not going to be very many probes because of the low polymorphism. But it's true that we don't actually control for that right now. That's actually one of the reasons that it's nice that we have these three different probes that give the same picture. So to talk very briefly about the general model of this analysis, we've got three variables, and they're all correlated with one another, and one of them is binary. So we've got this T0, which is a binary variable in color, and we've got trait 1, and we've got trait 2, and you know the mean of the different colored groups differs for trait 1 and for trait 2, and trait 1 and 2 are correlated. Everything is correlated. And so we have this very large number of possible causal network models that could explain this correlation. And one of the appealing things is that we can use conditional independence to distinguish among some of these causal orderings. So, for example, if T0 caused T1 and T2 independently, then knowing T1 would not tell us everything we need to know about T2 that T0 could. Or in another, perhaps more lucid example, if T0 causes T1 and T1 causes T2, then T1 tells us everything that T0 possibly could. There's no information left from T0 to inform T2. So T2, given T1, is conditionally independent of T0, if that's the causal ordering. So with these simulated data, indeed, if we look at T2, it's conditionally independent of T0 given T1. Right now, the means of the two color groups are identical once we take T1 into account. And if we do the reverse, then in fact everything remains correlated. T1 given T2 is not independent of T0. So that takes this large set of possible causal orderings and turns it into a smaller set so that we could have now T0 causing T1 causing T2 or vice versa or so forth. These are the smaller universe of possible causal orderings that are left when we have this conditional independence statement. And the beautiful thing about the QTL data, and the central fact here, is that one of these variables is a genotype, and in a properly controlled cross, that cannot be caused by the phenotype. So the genotype gives us a causal anchor so that we can exclude all of the things that have errors leading into T0 here, if that's the genotype. And we're left from these data with this nice causal ordering. The genotype affects T1, T1 affects T2. And that's the basic model for how we can use conditional independence in conjunction with QTL data to go from general statements about genetic correlation to more explicit statements about causal networks of phenotypic variation. So to return to the example with SED1, here's SED1 transcript abundance. Here's transcript abundance of SCRM6. This is a scramblase, which is also it's a candidate gene class for involvement in cell death. So it's plausibly related to cell death processes. And you can see that they're correlated, and that scramblase 6 has a dependence on genotype at the same locus that SED1 depends on genotype. So I showed you how SED1 is related to genotype at a QTL. This is the same QTL now colored orange and blue, and you can see that the Hawaii allele at that QTL is associated with higher scramblase 6, the Bristol allele with lower. So now if we simply ask whether scramblase 6 depends on genotype given SED1, it turns out that it doesn't. That once we take SED1 phenotype into account, the dependence of scramblase 6 abundance on genotype goes away. So the basic
conditional expressions, you're just,
it's just a linear.
Linear,
yeah, exactly. Yep, that's the whole thing. So another way to look at this is with the LOD score profiles. Here's the LOD score along chromosome 1 for these two phenotypes, SED1 and scramblase 6 transcript abundance. And you can see that they both have significant linkages to this region of chromosome 1. And if we now make new traits that subtract out this linear fit of each phenotype on the other, it turns out that scramble A6, conditional on SED1 abundance, has no linkage here at all. It's a complete flat line. And the reverse is not true. SED1 remains dependent on this genotype. This is just another visual representation of the plot I just showed, that this conditional independence gives us a sort of causal ordering, that SED1 is affected by genotype, and that SED1 phenotype affects scramble A6. And the really nice thing about this is that when we look at this QTL interval here, it's a pretty modest interval. It's got these genes in it. Right in the center of this interval is SED1 itself. So if we take this causal ordering scenario literally, then we've inferred a molecular pathway here that there's some SED1 regulatory polymorphism that's affecting transcript abundance, and that's affecting scramble A6. And what I didn't mention just now is that this is the same QTL that's affecting cell death-related nuclease 3 and all of the other genes in one of the big vertical stripes on the plot of all of the QTLs. So this is just simply an introduction to this idea that we can use these correlations plus the QTLs to get a richer description of multivariate heritability. And
if you have feedbacks, what?
Yes, that is a great question. It's a very big problem. So. Yes. So the approach that I've described, feedbacks are impossible. You can't allow them. And this is true for all of the Bayesian network models that exploit this to go into larger numbers of traits. So that's fairly a disaster. And you know, we know that feedback is going to be ubiquitous in all biological systems. So one approach that people are beginning to take with this kind of data is to use structural equation models which permit feedback. But they're very much more challenging. Right now they're very limited in the number of traits that can be included. So this has this nice property that if you've just got two traits in a QTL and you're willing to make assumptions about feedback, then it's sort of trivial. But it's absolutely true that this is not a biologically complete description in any way, and whether it's biologically appropriate at all is, I think, very much up for grabs. So I think it's a promising avenue for future work to make this multivariate genetic correlation stuff into something more about pathways between genotype and phenotype. So I want to just end by showing you what we think is probably actually represented by this SED1 variation. And it raises another problem with the kind of data we're looking at, which is that we're looking at transcript abundance, which is not the same as transcription rate or stability of the RNA or anything like that. It's about how many molecules there are in a whole animal, whole worm, which has many different kinds of cell types. And so if we look at a whole worm, it turns out that most of the worm is germline. It's this sort of bluish stuff here that extends all the way up in here and loops back here and on both sides. Worms by volume, when they're adults, are mostly germline. And so all of the rest of the cells in C. elegans have completely determined cell lineage. There's a fixed number of them. But the germline doesn't have a fixed cell number, and it goes through a lot of development within adults. And so there is the possibility that when we're measuring transcript abundance, what we're really looking at is different proportions of different kinds of differentiated cell states in the germline. So we're measuring basically germline cell demography. So here's a picture of nuclei in one gonad of a hermaphrodite. There's a spermathecum here, and there's a distal tip cell here that's making new proliferating nuclei by mitosis, and then they go through various states of maturation. And right over here, before they turn into mature oocytes, there's a big zone of programmed cell death in which there's tons of apoptosis that causes some of these nuclei and cells basically to act as nurse cells to provide nutrients for the other cells which eventually differentiate into oocytes. So when we're talking about SED1 affecting scramble A6, what we really mean possibly is that SED1 is influencing the activity in this programmed cell death zone, maybe to push it this way, maybe to push it this way, such that we have different numbers of cells in different states, and that those different cells may have different abundances of scramble A6 for unrelated reasons. So this is just, again, a caveat, basically, about this kind of analysis, that when we look at whole animals, we have this problem of cellular demography. And this is going to be true of every kind of study, so far at least, that's looked at transcript abundances in a genetic context. So all of the studies use mixtures of cell types. Even those studies that look at single-celled animals like yeast have used growing populations. So these are not synchronized cells. And so when we have genetic differences between populations of yeast that are genetically different, that could be simply differences in the fraction of time they spend in particular stages of the cell cycle. So all of the data on the genetics of gene expression, of which there are now many studies, have this problem that they're not measuring transcription rates or RNA abundance, RNA stability. They're measuring the whole population of stuff in this dynamic system. So I'm not going to propose any solutions to that problem, and I don't even know how big a problem it is. It's just something that we need to keep in mind. So let me just keep...
For some systems, people make a lot of effort to, you know, sort cells and so on to get very homogeneous populations, right? I mean, people that do, like, development...
So the techniques exist. They haven't been applied in this genetic context where you have to do it for hundreds of strains. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's room for this to happen. I want to conclude by acknowledging folks in the Krugliak Lab at Princeton, which is where I collected most of these data, and everybody in the worm community who's provided me with strains and advice and all this other great stuff. Here are some people who have funded this work. I'm now at New York University. And thanks.
So, do you know, as you look across the chromosomes, if, for instance, like housekeeping genes are more likely to sit in the center or more likely to sit in the arms?
That's a really good question. So, I haven't systematically analyzed that in relation to these data, but the literature makes it pretty clear that there's much more rapid turnover in gene families in the arms. So they seem to be enriched for things that are, there's definitely a differentiation among arms and centers in the kinds of genes that are there. And I don't know per se about housekeeping, but things that are putatively involved in pathogen resistance are greatly enriched on the arms. So there's absolutely an effect of that.
Sintony is there with the other
genomes. Yeah, the sintony is, you know, there are many ways you could describe it that make it sound better or worse. But things that are in arms tend to stay in arms, and things that are in centers tend to stay in centers, although maybe not the same arms or centers. And the bigger problem for comparative analyses is that the sequence divergence is so huge, and the gene content turnover is so huge, that it's very difficult to get a good handle on orthology or estimate sequence distances reliably.
And no one's yet tried to construct genetic maps for any of the outcrossing species.
Oh, no. No, it's, yeah, this is, a lot of people are beginning to think about it seriously, but the major problem is actually that these guys just live so fast that, and it's hard to get material from one worm. So, so if you were to do that analysis, you can't make inbred lines with the outcrossers because of inbreeding depression. So you'd have to basically do an F2 and then take individual worms and genotype them. And, you know, that's totally doable, but then you've consumed your material, in effect, so then you can't do anything with them later. So, yeah, a map could be made, but I think people are trying to figure out a way to develop the systems so that we could make inbred lines or do something where we could then have resources for mapping.